from the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, we in this country consume, on average, an astounding 175 pounds of meat per year per person. That's almost 15 pounds of beef, pork, chicken, and turkey per person per month. Not only does such a large consumption have an impact on our health, but a huge impact on our environment.
That's a huge amount of meat.
Yes.
The UN Food and Agriculture Organization says that nearly 20% of greenhouse gases can be attributed to raising animals for food, such as cattle, sheep, and goats, since they have multiple stomachs and produce large quantities of methane.
Mm-hmm. And in addition, raising and producing meat requires large amounts of feed, water, electricity, fuel, pesticides, and antibiotics, not to mention the tremendous volumes of manure and other biological waste that has to be managed and treated.
When our health and environment are considered, is it really worth eating all this meat? Emily Cassidy is a research analyst with the Environmental Working Group, and she joins us in the first part of the show to answer these and other questions on love of meat and its impacts to our planet.
Right, then in the second half of the show, we'll cover some news items, including a Colorado judge that says you can calculate the social costs of coal mining, a study that shows that out here in the West, we're consuming as much, if not even more, groundwater than surface water.
Yikes.
Yeah, and then if we have some time, I'll share my little experiment comparing Indonesian farm shrimp with Honduran chemically free shrimp. What the heck does all that mean, and is it worth it? It's This Green Earth, and I'll get started right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
Your daughter takes a fall on her bike, and you're not sure what's really going on with her aches and pains. I'm Dr. Lisa Saturnino at Intermountain Instacare. We gladly accept walk-in patients. No appointment needed. Our Instacare in Park City is located at 1665 Bonanza Drive. We have a new call-ahead number to reserve an arrival time. Call 435-649-7705. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, formerly Prudential, Utah. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW and are excited to embark on the next era of Park City real estate under our new brand. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Co-host Nell Larson is across the board. And joining us on the phone is Emily Cassidy. She's a research analyst with the Environmental Working Group. And among other things, Environmental Working Group does a lot of interesting research and analysis and the studies associated with our meat production and consumption in this country. And as we said in the intro, we cited some astounding numbers, including the fact that on average, each American consumes roughly 15 pounds of beef, pork, chicken, and turkey per month. And Nell, you and I were saying at the in the prepping for the show that that means somebody out there is eating about 25 pounds of turkey.
That's right.
To make up for what little we consume as far as meat. And so, Emily Cassidy, thanks for joining Nell and myself on This Green Earth to talk more about this subject.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start here with some additional background information. If we're consuming roughly 175 pounds of meat per year per person, how does that compare with say, other countries? Are we number one?
In this case, we're not number one. We come in at about number three. It changes somewhat over the years, but in 2011, we were the third biggest meat eater in the world. We were slightly beat by Australia and New Zealand.
Oh. Wow.
I was just about to ask what countries could possibly out-meet us.
Right.
Well, that's blame the barbecue for that, all right? Okay. Is that a lot? Is 175 pounds per year, is that a lot of meat to be consuming?
I think it is a lot. I think it's about twice the global average, although there are, you know, some people in the world who aren't eating enough meat, and mm-hmm. Enough protein, rather. So it's quite a bit, although recently there have been studies that show that meat consumption in the U.S. per person isn't increasing that much. It's actually stagnating. And some studies suggest that that's because Americans are increasingly concerned about the health impacts of meat.
Right. Okay. So it's kind of, we kind of peaked then maybe a couple of decades ago, and then we're just kind of flat now?
Actually just recently that we peaked within the last few years. Meat consumption in the U.S. in the last 50 years doubled. But in very recent years, we are stagnating.
Okay.
So what drove that pattern of increasing consumption of meat for decades?
Yeah, so as people get richer, they typically eat more animal products, fats, and sugars. And so we're seeing that trend globally in the world. It's happening especially in places like China and some increasingly affluent African nations are starting to eat more meat and starting to want to eat more like Americans.
So what is the global, you know, average or meat consumption, and how is that changing?
Well, like I said, I think the global average is about half of the average American consumption of meat, and that is global meat consumption is increasing a lot in recent years. In fact, there are studies that show that meat production is going to have to double by 2050 in order to meet the demand, because as people get richer, they want to consume more meat and dairy.
Right. And when we say meat, you know, let's be clear, we're talking things like beef, hogs, lamb, chicken, turkey, and then, like you said, Emily, dairy products too are included in this, because that cheese and milk, et cetera, right? So that's what we mean by that?
Right, exactly. So when we look at what kinds of meat and dairy the world eats, we actually eat a lot more dairy. We get a lot more of our protein from dairy products than we do from meat.
Okay. So let's talk about some of the environmental impacts for a minute. Which one of those, whether it's beef, pigs, sheep, chicken, does one have a bigger environmental impact than another?
Yeah, so a recent study that just came out shows that beef has roughly 10 times the environmental impact of any other kind of meat. And so they looked at the land requirements and the irrigation water associated with producing different kinds of meat, and they also looked at the greenhouse gas emissions associated with producing meat. And they found that when you compare all the different kinds of meat, beef far and away has a bigger environmental footprint than other kinds.
Right. I'm reading here, and the study says beef requires 28 times more land and 11 times more irrigation water than most other animal products, and results in 5 times the greenhouse gas emissions. Now, does that matter much if it's, let's say, grass-fed beef versus more your classic industrial CAFO type raised beef?
Right. So in the Environmental Working Group's Meat Eater's Guide, we recommend that grass-fed beef can be better nutritionally because it has less saturated fat and it, in general, has a better nutritional profile. But when we look at the environmental impacts of grass-fed versus grain-fed, they don't differ a whole lot. Some recent studies show that grass-fed may actually have more greenhouse gas emissions associated with it, although grass-fed beef might be better for water quality because it's not, you know, depending on the corn production in the Midwest. And also, It requires a lot less irrigation water than grain-fed beef.
Okay.
So what about the distances that this beef is traveling to get to us? If you eat local beef or meat, how much of an impact does that have versus eating something that's been shipped halfway around the world?
Right. So in Environmental Working Group's Mediator's Guide, we looked at these different life cycle impacts. So not only did we look into how different kinds of meats are produced, but also how they're processed and they're shipped and packaged and even cooked. And what we found was that the biggest environmental impacts of different kinds of meat and dairy are associated with the production stage. So that's producing the animal feed, you know, the fertilizers and water that goes into that. And in the case of beef, it's the methane that people politely call cow burps. So the most of the environmental impact is associated with those stages of production. We did find that, you know, the packaging and transportation part of meat production accounted for roughly 10 to 20% of the emissions associated with meat. So buying local and grass-fed, you know, locally raised grass-fed could reduce emissions by a small amount, but more importantly, you know, the Mediator's Guide recommends that we reduce meat consumption and think about the different kinds of meat that we're eating.
So does the Environmental Working Group have a recommendation on what should be, you know, the average person's goal of how much meat to eat or not eat?
So rather than sort of give a number saying that people should eat X amount of meat, we recommend eating less meat. For example, if every American went meatless just one day a week, it would decrease emissions the equivalent of taking 7.6 million cars off the road. So that could be a significant reduction in emissions, but also we looked into switching from beef to chicken, for example, could reduce our diet-related emissions by about 50%. So eating less, but also just eating less beef or switching from grain-fed to grass-fed, there are a lot of different ways that we could reduce the environmental impacts of our diets.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the other meat sources. What about lamb, you know, goats, other, you know, pigs? Where do these others fall between? Are they between chicken and beef somewhere?
So, yeah, so the main driver of the greenhouse gas emissions associated with meat production is whether or not the animal is what we call a ruminant. So, as I mentioned before, cows belch a lot, and because they have this intricate, they have many stomachs, essentially, and that allows them to turn grass into essentially food for for cattle. And so when we look at ruminants, which are things like beef cattle and lamb, they have higher emissions because they're emitting a very powerful greenhouse gas called methane. And so reducing beef and lamb consumption can reduce our emissions. So things like chicken and pork and these single-stomached animals have a lot less emissions than beef.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Emily Cassidy. She's a research analyst with the Environmental Working Group, and we're talking about meat and meat consumption here in the U.S. and the environmental impacts associated with consuming meat. Along those lines, I found this fascinating that chicken do not emit methane, burp or otherwise. I don't know what's going on in a chicken's stomach, but I did not know that they do not emit methane. So that's good for the chicken. Well, good for us, the greenhouse gases with respect to chicken. So
right.
So the point there is that compared to beef, hogs, et cetera, chicken are a little better for the environment and also more efficient at converting feed, let's say, into meat. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. So beef require a lot more feed. The numbers differ a lot by sort of what you're referring to, but the feed conversion for beef has a lot to do with less than 50% of beef cattle is actually edible to humans. And so a lot of the feed that goes into producing beef cattle is actually doesn't go into the meat. So that makes them a lot less efficient at converting corn and grass into human edible protein. Whereas chickens are smaller animals and they convert most of that feed to human edible meat.
So let's talk about cheese a little bit and dairy products, because it's not something we think about a lot. You know, I think we think, okay, if you're a vegetarian, you've made a big step, but cheese generates the third highest emissions. So talk a little bit about that process and where that comes from.
Yeah, so dairy products are produced from dairy cows, and dairy cows are also, as I mentioned, ruminants that emit methane. And so although eating cheese is a lot better for our carbon footprint than eating beef, it's still associated with the greenhouse gas emissions of you know, ruminant production.
And how does all this meat, say, compare with fish, say salmon or so?
So fish has a lot better conversion of feed. So some studies find that the conversion efficiency of fish can be 1.5 or 2 pounds of feed for every pound of fish. And so depending on the species of fish, we can get a lot of fish meat from from the feed that goes into it. And recent USDA recommendations recommend that Americans eat more fish, but we also have to be concerned with the mercury that's in a lot of species of fish. And in general, if we eat smaller species of fish, like herring and sardines, things like that typically have less mercury in them.
Right, so a little farther down on the food chain.
Right.
Smaller fish. And also perhaps U.S.-raised fish. We have an ongoing conversation about fish that comes from other parts of the world, specifically Southeast Asia. We're going to do a little thing on that later. But fish in large has a smaller footprint, smaller carbon intensity than beef. That's good.
Yeah.
Okay. So you said that the trends are flat. Do you see the trends kind of remaining flat, or at least here in the U.S. maybe decreasing with better awareness like this?
Well, hopefully. I mean, we spend a lot of our natural resources here in the U.S. A lot of our land and water goes into producing meat and dairy. For example, I recently authored a paper that says 67% of all of the calories we produce in the U.S. goes towards animal feed. And that was in the year 2000. Right, that's in the year 2000. And so there's been a recent shift, less, you know, more towards corn ethanol and less towards animal feed. But, you know, we're still directing a lot of our natural resources and calories towards producing meat and dairy. And so, you know, if we shifted our diets towards less meat intensity, we could potentially make our croplands a lot more efficient at actually feeding people.
Well, I'm sorry, but here in Utah is a perfect example of that. The majority of water that we consume in this state goes to farming, and the majority of that farming is to grow alfalfa, which is a source of food for animals. So there's the connections there.
Exactly.
So, all right. So what about alternatives, protein alternatives? If I don't want to eat meat, but I still need my protein, what do you suggest?
So there's a lot of protein in vegetables. I think we often forget that there's protein in things that don't come from animals. Mm-hmm. Like some people are surprised to find out that things like broccoli and asparagus actually have a fair amount of protein in them. But also the traditional plant-based proteins like legumes, beans, and lentils have a lot of protein. But if you don't want to give up meat and you prefer to eat meat, in general, eating smaller kinds of meat can reduce our environmental footprint. And the Meat Eater's Guide also recommends, if it's affordable and accessible switching to organic kinds of meat, too, for the environmental benefits.
Okay.
So you've referenced the Meat Eater's Guide several times. So give us an overview of what that is and how our listeners can get their hands on that.
Sure. So the Meat Eater's Guide was produced by Environmental Working Group, and you can find it at ewg.org. And what we did there is we looked at the life cycle impacts of different kinds of meat, and we also looked at dairy. So we looked at how different kinds of meat were produced and how they're processed and transported to figure out what are the different climate impacts of different kinds of meat. And so what we found was that meat that comes from sheep and beef cattle, lamb and beef, actually have higher carbon impact than other kinds of meat like chicken and pork. So what we recommend is not only that we reduce meat consumption to reduce our climate impact, but also switch from beef to pork and chicken, which can have less environmental impact.
Okay, so the encouraging news seems like here in the U.S., maybe our meat consumption is at least flat. It's not growing, and it may even decrease a bit. But the challenge then is in like those developing nations, China, India, where, like you say, with growing economic development and GDP, there's a desire to enjoy more beef or pigs. I know India has some cultural limitations on the meat they consume, but overall, that's where the meat consumption is going to be in the coming years.
The world is facing a protein problem. In the coming decades, we're going to realize that we're going to have to increase crop production to feed animals to satisfy the increasing demands for meat. And so the challenge for the 21st century is going to be, how can we double meat production without also doubling its environmental impact?
You know, you mentioned that protein problem, and that's actually something that Chris and I covered on this show about a year ago, and we talked about insects as a possible source of protein
right.
in certain parts of the world.
Yeah, has EWG taken a look in that, doing any research there?
You know, we haven't yet. That is a fascinating avenue of research, though. I think that they potentially could, increase the amount of protein available to people. They're pretty good converters of plants to protein, but we have to get over the hurdle of that not being something that we're culturally used to eating, I think.
Absolutely, because there's a local, there's a company here in Salt Lake City that produces a protein bar made from ostensibly Jamaican cricket flour.
That's right.
And it was fine.
They're tasty. It's better than fine.
And there's my protein delivery system. But you're right. There's definitely a serious perception issue here in the U.S. with eating bugs.
So, Emily, before we let you go, let's talk a little bit about the policies behind this food production. So is meat or dairy or vegetables, for that matter, are they being made artificially, inexpensive? What kinds of government policies exist?
Right. So in the U.S., there's a lot of subsidies, especially for grains. And in fact, we did a farm subsidy study at Environmental Working Group, and we have a database of who's receiving subsidies and what kinds of crops they're producing. And what we found is that in, I think it was 2011, that corn received twice as much subsidies as any other crop. Now, corn is a big crop in the U.S. It's, the top crop that we produce, essentially. But, we're investing a lot of money into these subsidies. And so I think one of the things that we could do is look into where these subsidies are going and who they're going to. If we took away some of these subsidies, we could probably see a reduction in meat consumption as corn becomes less cheap.
Okay, well, again, Emily Cassidy, research analyst with Environmental Working Group, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us all about meat and its impacts on the planet. The Environmental Working Group website?
EWG.org.
Simple enough. And you have, in addition to meat, you guys cover lots of other issues with respect to the environment, correct?
That's correct. Yep, we're looking into mostly how, you know, human health impacts how what we produce and the stuff that we put on our bodies impacts human health. And so that's most of our investigations go into that.
We do great work, and we touch base with it now and then, and I urge our listeners to do the same. Emily Cassie, thanks again for chatting with us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's take a break for some underwriters. And we come back, we got a bunch of news items to cover, including, well, let's segue into my shrimp story. That's meat.
That's right.
And that's a story. It's This Green Earth.
Adventures.
Stay tuned.
I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Join us for Cool Science Radio Thursdays at 9 a.m.
From the discovery of new dinosaurs to the science of an avalanche.
From the secret technology behind Facebook to nanotechnology.
Deciphering science and tech in an entertaining, amusing, and accessible way.
It's Cool Science Radio. If we understand it, so can you.
Thursdays at 9 a.m. only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you by Peak, Art and Frame, and Nexus IT.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth. Rocky Mountain Power WattSmart New Homes Program offers incentives for building a new energy-efficient home that can help you enjoy year-round comfort, higher resale value, and lower energy bills. To learn more or find a builder in your area, WattSmart.com.
Hi, I'm Maren Mullen, and I'm a Recycle Utah board member. Did you know that water conservation is what we're really all about? And you thought it was only recycling. We save your H2O. How? By encouraging you to recycle more, by teaching our students how to conserve water, and by making it possible for you to drop off hazardous waste at our collection events. Yep, we're all about saving your water, because we can't live without it. Recycle Utah is a nonprofit organization bringing conservation ideas to you since 1990. Check us out at recycleutah.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that's co-host Chris Cherniak on the other side of the board, giving us all the thumbs up. And in the second half of the show, we have some news highlights from the past week, but we're going to start out with Chris's adventures in meat eating, and specifically as that relates to shrimp.
Shrimp.
Yeah. I mean, good option, low on the food chain.
Low on the food chain. The most consumed, let's say, fish or aqua cultured species in the country, right? Compared to salmon or other forms of fish. Shrimp is, we consume more shrimp than anything else.
Any other
from
seafood?
The oceans. Any other sea? Thank you very much. Any other sea? Shrimp. By far. And there's a whole number of reasons why that is, why we've taken to it. One big one is the fact that it's inexpensive, and it's inexpensive because most of it is farm-raised, and most of it is farm-raised and comes from Southeast Asia.
Right, it's a huge industry there, the aquaculture industry.
Yeah, and there are lots of issues associated with that, which we'll get into in a minute. So you go to the supermarkets here, and you have a variety, different types of shrimp, but they're either coming from Vietnam, they're coming from China, they're coming from Thailand. Sometimes the Philippines, and none from the U.S., at least what I looked at. Maybe our listeners can, you know, identify shrimp that comes from the U.S. waters that is available here at the supermarkets. Go on our Facebook page and let us know. But so I went to the local supermarket here, and they had a farmed shrimp from Thailand, and another shrimp that was interesting from Honduras, and it was described as chemically free. Okay, so all right, I'll take that bait. And so what I did was I bought a little bit of each. Okay.
Okay. A little taste testing.
Yeah. I'm sorry. This was Indonesian farm shrimp and Honduran chemical-free shrimp.
Okay. Right, so I didn't know. Did this chemical-free shrimp come with any kind of certification?
No.
Okay.
In a word, no. I just said in quotes, chemically free shrimp from Honduras. The guys behind the counter was like, well, it's probably, we're not sure, but it means that it's probably not, it's free of antibiotics.
Huh.
Okay. Right. Okay. Because farmed shrimp throughout Southeast Asia has antibiotics applied to the ponds. It may have pesticides applied to them. It has algicides applied to them. They're farmed in very tight quarters, so there's waste issue. It's, believe me, if you saw how the shrimp looks, yes, exactly. Now, shaking your head, you would not eat fish from Southeast Asia.
When I was working on my master's, a fellow student was working on hers in relation to shrimp aquaculture
really?
In Thailand, and so I have heard the stories.
Yeah, and of course, in such tight quarters, the chances for infection go up and disease, and that's why so many antibiotics are applied, and so you get it. It's like the CAFOs of beef here.
CAFOs being concentrated animal feeding organizations.
Thank you very
operations,
much.
Operations.
CAFOs. CAFOs, and so it's shrimp CAFOs over there. So Honduran shrimp, chemically free, they say, well, it could mean that probably not antibiotics, but no guarantee that maybe there's pesticides or algicides or other chemicals applied. They weren't sure. I did a research on it. I found nothing associated specifically with chemical-free shrimp from Honduras. What it may mean is that in addition to maybe fewer antibiotics or lack of antibiotics, the farming operations are a little larger. The shrimp have a little more room. But they're not wild shrimp. They're also farmed-raised shrimp. Okay, so I take these two types of shrimp. What does it mean as far as flavor and taste and cookability or whatever, and put them in a pan, same pan, and just oil, a little salt, and, you know, controlled conditions as best I can. And I would say the Indonesian shrimp tasted what you would think it would. It had a shrimpy, fishy flavor to it. It was a little limper in its meat texture. Mm-hmm. And you know, it wasn't inedible, but that's what you get. The Honduran shrimp was interesting because it had a firmer meat, but it had little flavor. So it's like it would be the perfect shrimp for mixing it into a salad or a stir fry or something, because it had a nice texture to it. But I couldn't taste, you know, taste-wise, it's not dramatically different. So the point is, the takeaway here is, look for U.S. shrimp. Ask the... your fishmonger at the supermarket to provide U.S.-based shrimp, whether it's from the West Coast or whether it's from the Gulf. It's
right.
Much better. It's raised under better controlled systems. We have better regulations. We have better standards. We have better labor practices, better environmental conditions. And you know what? You'll pay a premium for it. Yes, you'll pay $3 or $4, $5 more per pound, but it's worth it.
That's right.
Okay, so there's my takeaway, my little story of Honduran shrimp versus Indonesian shrimp.
I think it's also worth noting, you know, we've done stories on seafood and sort of, I guess, chain of custody, you know, after it's caught, where it goes, how it's processed. It ends up at the store, and the guy at the counter doesn't even have the full story on where it came from or what chemical-free means or where it was raised. And so that's another thing to, you know, keep asking.
That's a great point now, because that just remembered that there have been some instances where China-farmed shrimp has passed through Thailand and it's relabeled.
Yes.
Much like adulterated honey and other things that come from China. They go into another country, Thailand, India, so they get relabeled as a product of that country and then shipped here to the U.S. So, yes, there's a serious lack of credibility with respect to a lot of that food that comes from Southeast Asia. Did we just lose Southeast Asia as an underwriter?
I think we did. I think we did. We've already made China angry with our policy on
now
China.
Now we just brought it into
if
the
it's
whole
from China, don't
Southeast
put it in your mouth.
Asia. Yes, exactly. All right, so that's the shrimp story. And let us know on Facebook page what you guys think about U.S. shrimp versus foreign shrimp.
That's right.
What's your thoughts on that? And if you want us to do more research on that, let us know. So next story, who's next?
Let's go EJ.
Okay.
All right, EJ, what do you
So have? EJ Elliott.
Our news intern this summer.
Yes.
Got a couple stories.
Let's start with Colorado. So the West Elk coal mine in Colorado, they were looking for to expand, mm-hmm. like most coal mines are, because of energy consumption needs. And a federal judge in Denver ruled in June that the government wrongly dismissed as impossible its ability to quantify the climate cost of expanding a Western Colorado coal mine. So the cost that he was referring to is not the cost of actually expanding the mine, but he's talking about the social cost. So that's the thing that you're going to hear about, like the effect on like asthma or like what it's going to cost for climate change, like sea level rises, like just like the health, like everything that's associated with building the coal mine, not the actual coal mine expenses.
Okay.
And so the government officials were trying to say, oh, you can't quantify that. Yeah. We can't be held responsible.
Exactly. The government officials, because, you know, environmental groups were like, let's not have this coal mine be expanded. So they sued. And the government officials are saying, well, you can't quantify what is going to happen. So, but in 2010, this is where the ruling was based off of. In 2010, the U.S. government created a formula designed for these social costs so that federal agencies could quantify these costs. Mm-hmm. So the judge pointed that out, said, look, we have this available. You mm-hmm. can use these resources. And what the mine already cost with the social cost was about $900 million already. That was the social cost of the mine without the expansion.
Without the expansion.
Exactly. Okay. So if we added the expansion, you have to account for those costs and see where all that money is going to. And is it really worth it? So it brings in a good question of where we're going to go with our energy expansion. So we have to start looking at, okay, how is this going to affect the rest of the world with the climate change and with health? We have to start looking at those things now.
Well, it's an excellent piece because we often overlook those pieces. We are only looking at the immediate local impacts, the local stream, the local
air quality. Things that can be quantified much better than trying to quantify the economics associated with mm-hmm. bad air, contaminated groundwater, ash ponds failing and damaging a river, and then loss of fish and habitat. How do you quantify that? How does Swan
or sea level rise for that matter?
Okay. I mean, how do you quantify the Swan or Basin, you know, your area in terms of the value it brings to the local economy?
Right.
Is that possible?
People have made attempts at quantifying what they call ecosystem services, which is kind of the flip side of this. You know, some operations are impacting, you know, a broad array of environmental you're having a really broad array of environmental impacts that are hard to quantify. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it's hard to quantify the benefits coming from a place. But there are things you can look at, like, okay, you know, this wetland is cleaning this water and it's taking out X amount of nutrients. And in order to build a facility to carry out this same practice, it would cost this many millions of dollars. Or this wetland is storing water. It's storing this amount of water that's then slowly released during the dry season. Well, to build a reservoir to do that same thing would cost this many millions of dollars. So there are ways to quantify, but it's a difficult practice.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could also quantify the recreational benefits.
Absolutely.
X amount of people fish on this stream, which provides Y amount of dollars in terms of license or other economic benefits to the local community.
Right. Or the health benefits,
of
having open spaces around is huge. And there's all kinds of research to quantify, you know, the decrease in obesity, decrease in stress, decrease in blood pressure, increase in fitness, even things, you know, it gets into the cognitive field too. Like, people are smarter, they do better on tests, they respond to problem solving better, they're more creative. How do you quantify that exactly? I don't know.
Right.
But
there's no simple algorithm to do that.
Yeah.
But it's there. And in this case, going to loop back, so this judge said, you know what, you can quantify the impacts, the social costs associated with this mine expansion, and that needs to be considered.
Mm-hmm. At least take a stab at it.
Yeah, so right now it's temporary. The coal expansion has been blocked for just this time being until the federal agencies look back and decide like go through the formula and see what is it affecting if they make that expansion.
Okay.
And this is just next door in Colorado.
Yeah. Exactly. All right. Let's take another quick break for a couple underwriters. We'll come back. We got a couple of additional news stories on groundwater issues here out west.
That's right. And the false balance of sort of climate science and climate deniers in the press.
Perfect. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned right after these words from our underwriters.
This is Dana Edwards on behalf of Vail Resorts and Cannons Resort supporting KPCW. This year, we developed partnerships with 25 local nonprofits to support programs like the fourth grade program at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Every fourth grader in Summit County will experience Utah's ecosystem firsthand and see science come to life through infield classes. Thanks to Swanner for making science cool.
Since 1983, we've been trying to say something clever in support of our favorite radio station. This is Jeff from Park City Nursery and the Park City Tree Ranch, complimenting KPCW for making interesting radio under strict regulations. We try to do the same given our short growing season, various microclimates, and soils. We know what grows at parkcitynursery.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. She's EJ Elliott and Nell Larson. We're doing some news items. Things that we come across that we feel
don't
are,
sound too excited.
Yeah. No, these are really interesting. The social cost of mining Honduran shrimp, and now climate change issue.
That's right. And so this all kind of starts with the 538 blog that comes from Nate Silver. Mm-hmm. And this was originally just his independent blog or website. Then it became part of the New York Times. And now it's part of ESPN. And he does all these really interesting statistical calculations. And he's made a big name for himself in the political arena in addition to sports, because he's predicted, like, the accuracy of his November 28th presidential election was what got him onto my radar, at least.
Right.
He correctly predicted the winner of 49 of the 50 states. He's just continued to have this really impressive success. So he's got this big website, and the organization hired a guy named Roger Pilkey to write some pieces for mm-hmm. this website. So, you know, these sort of statistically based pieces or math based pieces. And this guy is a political scientist and professor in the environmental studies program at the University of Colorado Boulder. So more news from Colorado,
wow.
I guess. But he is known for being kind of a climate skeptic or climate denier or climate misinformer, depending on where you read about him. And he published a piece with 538 on climate science. And there was a big backlash from the environmental community saying this is not, you know, this is not a legitimate piece.
Right.
And it had to do with, extreme events, extreme weather events, which is something there's a lot of buzz about and a lot of, you know, question about. But just yesterday it was announced that he has either been asked to leave or is leaving or will no longer be published in the 538 website. And so most people are interpreting this as, okay, Nate Silver took a close look at the data and realized that, you know, they're publishing misinformation.
Okay.
So they didn't say anything like, they didn't say we've been publishing misinformation. That's kind of where that led.
Right. So this is another example of, I guess, the journalistic industry saying that the arguments over climate change, whether it's occurring or not, are done. Because back in the fall, that's what we did. I think the LA Times announced that they would no longer be accepting printing op-ed pieces
or letters to the editor,
which basically were discussing whether or not climate change is occurring. That argument, that's over.
Right.
It's
and
done.
So that, you know, what you'll hear from various journalistic outfits is, okay, we need to have the balance. We need to show both sides of the issue. But in essence, groups like the LA Times and now the BBC, which we can talk about, are saying, okay, that's a false balance.
False
because
balance.
There isn't, you know, enough evidence on the evidence is overwhelming in favor of human caused climate change.
Right. So the days of having one talking head in saying it is happening, another talking head saying it's not, and considering that a balanced argument or discussion are done. Right. Now, on a sidebar, Roger Pilkey's starting his own blog, the 540 blog. He's announcing he's
going to be starting.
5:39. Exactly. One more minute. One more minute.
But this is interesting, like, because the BBC recently actually came under fire from some members of Parliament. The Parliament's Science and Technology Committee stated that some editors appear to be particularly poor at determining the level of scientific expertise of contributors in debates, putting up lobbyists against top scientists as though their arguments on the science carry equal weight. Lobbying groups and other interested parties should be heard on the issue, but the BBC should be clear on the role of its interviewees and should not treat lobbying groups as disinterested experts. So they kind of got a little bit of a lashing from the Parliament, and then they have taken a stance, you know, a little more clearly on this, that the roles and the backgrounds of the people on their shows and on their debates
right.
will be...
I mean, that debate can still continue, but it won't continue on 538. It's not going to happen in the LA Times.
Right.
There'll be it's other places.
Not so much in the BBC.
Go to Sarah Palin's new website. And yes, she has a new website TV show. Yes. There's plenty of room for Roger Pilkey on Sarah Palin's website.
Right.
Okay. All right. We got time for another story or so. This one, EJ?
All right. Do you want to bash China some more?
It's one of Chris's favorite activities.
All right. What did they do now?
So China recently came out with their ceiling, we'll say, their adjustable ceiling on coal. So it's really not a ceiling. What they said is they're going to try to keep a limit on how much coal they're burning, but it's going to be adjusted to not just how their economy is doing, but how their economy is predicted to do. So if they think that it's going to be, you know, a great year, the economy is going to be growing, then this ceiling will be adjusted.
Will rise.
Exactly. So a lot of people have been bashing, like, China, saying, oh, like, this really isn't a ceiling. You're trying really hard. We understand.
Yeah.
But
yes,
this isn't anywhere close.
They're making an effort to try to again, quantify the amount of coal they're burning, maybe burn a little less coal, but they don't want to do it and risk economic growth.
Exactly.
So they're going to tie that burning of coal, consumption of coal, their mining of coal. You know, it's a huge industry. With their economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But the other point that you made is that it's just coal. It's not carbon.
Yeah, it's not their carbon emissions. It's just their coal use.
Okay.
So their nation's still going to have a lot of emissions.
Yeah, they still emit huge amounts of CO2 with respect to burning coal. And the other thing that's interesting is that they are a big leaders in coal gasification, which is just the process of taking coal and extracting fuel out of it in the form of a gas. And that might burn cleaner. In fact, it does burn cleaner in terms of particulate matter, PM2.5, PM10, and that's typically a big air polluter over there in the winter, is visible pollution like that. So that will be reduced. But when you gasify coal and you burn that, you produce even greater amounts of carbon dioxide, invisible. So there's the trade-off there. But they're trying to address their particulate matter first and foremost with respect to coal. So they got a number of things going on.
Well, they get a lot of bad press on that particulate matter front because we always see the photos the
stunning
downtown
Beijing is just
scenes.
Stunning.
Everyone with
bad
their little masks.
So they're trying to that's their biggest issue they're trying to address, and that's why they're turning to coal gasification.
But in a way, who are we to point fingers? I mean, when it's not like we're doing so outstandingly well on our energy sources here in Utah.
We're doing our, you're right. You're
in
right.
the US in general.
Hey, here in Utah, still the number seems to be 75% to 80% of our electricity comes from burning coal. We need to do better. We can do better.
That's right.
All right. All right. You know what? Last story. Got a couple minutes here. This one about our water sources here out west, the Colorado River Basin. A recent study suggests that although our surface water supplies are decreasing, and we see that with the increased, you know, visual bathtub rings in Lake Mead and et cetera, as surface water goes down. A recent study that's actually going to be posted in the Geophysical Research Letters of the Journal of the American Geophysical Union suggests that we out here in the West are consuming groundwater at even greater rates than we were once estimated. Two-thirds of the water lost over the past 9 years came from underground water supplies rather than surface water. So as our water supply here are just dwindling due to drought and
high use.
Over high use.
Yeah.
A lot more of that is being lost from the groundwater tables are being impacted at much greater rates than expected. While surface water in the Colorado River Basin is closely regulated by the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, okay, surface water, states are left to regulate groundwater on their own. Some states like California have no groundwater management rules. Others like Arizona have gone so far as to transfer surface water from the Colorado River into underground aquifers, right? So they're just taking surface water and using it to recharge underground aquifers for later use.
That's incredible. That's an incredible storage device. I mean, the drying up of wells is something we're seeing in this area too. When we had Mountain Regional Water on, our local water company here, they talked about how they're seeing a lot of the wells that they draw from start to dry up from this groundwater storage and aquifer storage.
Yeah. So out of sight, out of mind, and this article addresses that. Again, it's going to be published in the forthcoming issue of the Geophysical Research Letters. All right, that's it for the news item. Let's take one final break for some underwriters, and when we come back, it's time to wrap up. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Medical Center. This summer, we built a free community garden on the south side of the hospital as a way to help educate and empower our community to live well. We planted corn, tomatoes, peppers, beans, leafy greens, berries, squash, and much more. Many of the organic fruits and veggies are now ripe, so stop by and pick a few. It's all free. To learn how you can start making healthier lifestyle choices, schedule an appointment at our Live Well Center or visit parkcitymedicalcenter.org. Park City Medical Center is a nonprofit community hospital.
Hi, I'm Rachel Martin, host of Weekend Edition Sundays, where we do not shy away from asking the big questions. Join me Sundays on Weekend Edition from NPR News and let the conversation begin.
Beginning Sunday morning at 6.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, lrw-law.com. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. It's time to wrap up.
That's right. Another show has flown by.
Thanks again to Emily Cassidy, research analyst with Environmental Working Group. Interesting conversation all about meat.
That's right. Thanks to E.J. Elliott for some news highlights.
News highlights, always much appreciative. Thanks to our a new underwriter.
That's right. We want to thank Recycle Utah today, who's our newest underwriter of the show, and they're able to do that thanks to some community support.
Absolutely. They do great work over there. And not just recycling, water conservation,
That's
too.
That's right, as we heard from Maren Mullen on the...
Is that who the...
Yeah.
All right. And let's always thank our other underwriters for whom this show would not be possible. They include Republic Services.
Vail Resorts.
Rocky Mountain Power.
San Francisco Design.
Recycle Utah.
And Berkshire Hathaway Real Estate.
Hey, again, you can always join us on, like us on Facebook, KPCW, This Green Earth. In fact, that's where we got... well, maybe not through Facebook, but this story on meat was from a listener.
That's right. Thanks to Aaron Brown for suggesting this story on meat today.
And if you got suggestions for stories that you'd like us to cover, let us know. Either go to our Facebook page or email us at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. Remember, this is KPCW 91.9 FM, Park City.
Only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Thanks again, and NPR News is next.